Student Radio for Tampa Bay and the voice of Hillsborough Community College, streaming on the web 24/7.
You're listening to The Edge. Can written and oral statements provide clues to deceit? If so, how can we distinguish between truthful statements and those meant to lead us astray? Our guest today will discuss the answers to these questions. Mark McLish was in federal law enforcement for 26 years. He started his career in 1983 with the U.S. Secret Service Uniform Division, where he was assigned to the White House. In 1985, he was hired by the U.S. Marshals Service and served as a Deputy U.S. Marshal in Springfield, Illinois. In 1990, Mark was promoted to an instructor position at the U.S. Marshals Service Training Academy at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Glencoe, Georgia. In 1999, he left the Training Academy for an assignment in Greenville, North Carolina, where he served for almost 10 years as a Supervisory Deputy U.S. Marshal. Mark has authored the books I Know You Are Lying and Don't Be Deceived, and the Kindle ebook 10 Easy Ways to Spot a Liar. He is the developer of the Statement Analyzer software. Welcome to The Edge, Mark.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
Prior to your development of statement analysis, what methods were used to detect deception?
Primarily nonverbal communication techniques. That's been around for a long time, and I think every police officer gets trained in that, and usually throughout their career they may have several classes in it. But primarily looking at a person's nonverbal gestures and listening to what they're saying, but a lot of it, after years of asking questions and hearing answers, you're just going with your gut instinct as to if you think this person's being truthful or not.
How did you develop statement analysis?
Well, I spent 9 years teaching, as you mentioned, at our training academy, and I was assigned to teach interviewing techniques. And in preparation to train our students, they sent me to a variety of classes, such as word analysis, response analysis, scientific content analysis. And as I got into it, I found it to be very fascinating. So I decided to conduct my own research, and for the 9 years I was teaching at the academy, I would analyze various statements, but primarily watch role players. We would hire role players to play various roles in the scenarios that the students must complete, because it makes for realistic training. Instead of me, the instructor, going into the house and answering the door when the students knock on it, now when they knock on a door, it's answered by somebody they've never seen before. And these role players had a variety of roles to play: mother, father, girlfriend, boyfriend, sometimes the fugitive himself, because that's predominantly what our investigations in the Marshal Service are limited to. And we would tell them, in this scenario, answer the students' questions truthfully. But a lot of times we would tell them, lie to the students. Don't let the students know that your boyfriend, the fugitive, is hiding in your closet. But the key was, we didn't tell them how to lie. That wasn't scripted out. We just simply said, lie. And for 9 years, as I watched over 100 role players in a variety of scenarios, I found that they would all be deceptive in the same ways. And so just as the years went by, I continued to watch other statements, of course, prominent people in the news, and still to do that today. But it all starts coming to light when we analyze a person's language, exactly what they're saying. We can determine if they're being truthful or deceptive.
How does statement analysis compare to observation of microexpressions and body language?
Well, body language relies on the fact that when people knowingly tell a lie, it usually causes some internal stress, and that stress may be manifested in a form of a body movement. I mean, subtle changes to the body can be detected with a polygraph machine if the person's heart rate increases or breathing rate. But for some people, I mean, some people start blushing when they know they told a lie. And for other people, it may cause a tingling sensation in the back of their neck, or they may bring their hands to their mouth. And with microexpressions, it follows something similar to that, in that there will be certain movements in the face that people won't be able to control when they know they're telling a lie. And by observing these body movements, we can get an indication if they're being at least under some stress. But the problem is that stress doesn't always equate to deception. I mean, a person can perform a nonverbal cue and still be telling the truth, answering the question truthfully. It just may be that the interviewer is starting to hit on a sore subject, and the person's hoping that they don't keep asking questions about that. With statement analysis, we don't consider anything in terms of body language. In fact, we don't even need to see the person or even hear the person. We could take a written statement and determine if the person's being truthful or deceptive. Or we could use the statement analysis techniques in a telephone conversation where we can't see the person we're talking to. But again, just by analyzing how they phrase their statement and certain words that they use, we can determine exactly what they're saying, which includes if they're being truthful or deceptive.
Why is it that most people who have something to hide will not lie about it?
Well, I think most people are raised that you should always tell the truth. In some cases, you know, lying is wrong, perhaps a sin. You know, even a hardcore criminal doesn't know what the interviewer knows. And if he tells what the interviewer knows to be a lie, well, he just stuck his head in that proverbial noose. So the safest way for people to play it is to give you a truthful statement. And we're talking about an open statement where a person can say anything they want. For example, if I were to ask, you know, tell me what you did last night, very rarely will a person tell a lie. That they may leave out some incriminating information, but their statement itself will be a truthful statement. And the other reason they'll give a truthful statement is because, again, they know that if they tell a lie, it could cause that stress, which will then perhaps be manifested in a body movement. And so their non-verbs may give it away. So again, the safest way for people to play it is to give a truthful statement, and they can boldly proclaim that statement because it is a truthful statement. But by listening to what they haven't told us, that can lead to additional questions, and hopefully we're going to get to the truth.
Does eye contact have any bearing in detecting deception?
It does, in that some studies have shown that when a person looks up and to the right, they are accessing the creative part of their brain. In other words, they're making up the story. If a person's drawing the story from memory, they'll look up and to the left. The problem is, as I understand it, is that only applies if you're right-handed. If you're left-handed, then it's just the opposite. If you're looking up and to the left, then it's an indication you're making up the story. And so as we interview somebody, we don't necessarily know if they're left-handed or right-handed, especially if we're watching an interview on television, which again is why I don't rely on the non-verbs. The language itself, if that person is being deceptive, it's going to show up in the language. Generally, when you find some nonverbal cues that indicate deception, you will also see that the language will show it as well. They go hand in hand.
Why is it important to not interpret what a person tells you?
A couple of reasons. One is people mean exactly what they say. And of course, the other reason is that none of us are mind readers. And so when I do an analysis, it's just as you said, I am not interpreting what that person has said. I'm just simply pointing out what that person has said, or in some cases what they haven't said. But as you analyze a statement, and the more you use the statement analysis techniques, you'll find that to be true, that people mean exactly what they say.
Why is the usage of pronouns important in statement analysis?
Well, you can learn a lot by looking at the pronouns. Pronouns give us responsibility, and then sometimes people unknowingly take responsibility for what happened, and we usually see that with the pronouns. I've seen numerous statements where the person will refer to the victim as my victim. Well, the pronoun my is a possessive pronoun, and that person has just unknowingly admitted to committing the crime or killing this person by claiming them as their victim, my victim, as opposed to saying the victim or her. We've seen cases with David Westerfield, who several years ago was convicted of killing Danielle Van Damme. She disappeared from her home on a Friday night, and David Westerfield's alibi was he left Friday night and drove around the countryside by himself in his RV. And when he came home on Monday, he found the neighborhood was up in arms because Danielle was missing. Well, when the police interviewed him, he recounted what he did over the weekend driving around this RV. But at one point, he used the pronoun we. And of course, the pronoun we is a plural pronoun. And so he was telling the investigators that he was not by himself. And he was confronted on that. And ultimately, what we're hoping is to get a confession out of a person once we confront them on their language. But in this case, he wouldn't confess. And so he went to trial and, of course, was found guilty with some other fiber evidence proving that he indeed did kill Danielle Van Damme. But pronouns, as I said, can sometimes show a confession. I'd mentioned that pronouns give us responsibility. So if a person says, woke up at 7 o'clock, fixed breakfast, and read the newspaper. Well, we cannot believe they did that because they didn't use the pronoun I. They didn't say that I woke up and fixed breakfast or that I read the newspaper. And so the missing I is an indication that the person is not being truthful. Or it may be a matter of that they did do this stuff, but for some reason they don't want to tell us they did it, so they leave out the pronoun I. But there's a lot you can learn by looking at the pronouns.
Why is the use of verb tenses important in statement analysis?
Well, when a person's drawing their story from memory, everything, of course, will be in the past tense. It doesn't matter if something happened 5 minutes ago or 5 years ago. It's all going to be in the past tense as they tell us their story. And when present tense language appears in a statement, it's an indication that the person no longer is drawing their story from memory, but is now presently making it up. And because they are winging it, they unknowingly use present tense language. Now, we also have to take into account that a person may have poor grammar skills, and that may account for why they used a present tense language or the wrong verb tense. And if that's the case, we'd expect to see it not every time with every verb, but we'd expect to see it throughout their entire statement using the wrong verb tenses. But if it only appears at a certain portion of their statement, especially when they're talking about the incident itself, well, that's a stronger indication that it's not poor grammar skills, but that they stopped drawing the story from memory. They are now making it up, and present tense language appears in their statement. For example, if you were to ask somebody, have you used illegal drugs? And they responded, I don't use illegal drugs. Well, all they said was, I don't use illegal drugs, meaning at this exact moment in time, I'm not using illegal drugs. But the question was, have you used illegal drugs? And they didn't say, I didn't use illegal drugs, making it in the past tense.
What bearing does the event order of a narrative have on an attempt at deception?
In regards to order, is that what you're asking me about?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a reason why a person mentions things in a certain order. I mean, why they mention one name before another name before another name. And a lot of times it just means they like the first person better than perhaps the second person, or maybe it was the first person they mentioned was the one that invited them or is responsible for what was going on. But there's a reason why people mention things in a certain order. And if we look at that order, we can sometimes detect deception, sometimes gain additional information. You know, I was once driving down the road and I saw a sign for Played Against Sports. And it wasn't the typical company sign, but it was a sign that appeared to have been painted by the manager and placed out by the road to draw attention to his business. And what it said was, Played Against Sports, used and new sporting goods equipment. Now, I noticed that it was used and new, not new and used. And the reason he put used before new is because he has more used equipment in his store than he does new equipment. And if you go into a Played Against Sports, you'll see that to be true. They do sell new equipment, but they rely heavily on people selling them their old equipment, and then they resell it. So when he painted his sign, he didn't think, well, how should I phrase this, used and new or new and used? He just phrased it the way he knew it to be true. So it wasn't an indication of any deception, but we gain additional information by analyzing the order. And then there are times when people, if they're making up a statement, because they're not drawn up from memory, they may give an out-of-order statement. You know, when the story comes from memory, it's like a parade passing in front of a person. And they'll say, well, then this happened, then this happened. But when it gets to the point where they don't want to talk about something and now they're going to make it up, they no longer have that parade in front of them to rely upon, that memory. And so sometimes they may give a statement that's out of order. They may mention, for example, I've seen statements where a person said he was driving his car, a car pulled in front of him and stopped, and he said he was assaulted by three individuals. Well, okay, we believe what he's telling us. He was stopped, he was assaulted. Now the assault is on. But then he backs up in his statement and says that earlier when I drove around, I saw this same car. Well, the statement's out of order because he should have told us at the beginning he saw this car parked there. And then when he came around, they stopped him and robbed him. Because he's backing up in his story, we consider that to be an out of order statement. And it's an indication that the story's not coming from memory.
How is it that time references fit in with statement analysis?
Well, when we get a statement, especially a written statement, some people are very good at giving us a lot of time references, and some people don't. And if we have time references we can look at, that's good for us as the interviewer because we can now pin the person down to doing something at a certain specific time. And we can look at that to see One, is there any missing time? Deceptive people will quicken the pace of their story to get past those areas they don't want to talk about. And one way they do this is by skipping over something in time. If the person says that, you know, 8:30 I did this, then at 10 o'clock I did this, and then the next time references 4 o'clock in the afternoon, well, now we have, you know, about 6 hours that are missing. So we want to back them up and find out, what did they skip over? And we look to see, you know, how much of the statement is devoted to certain parts of the time. And the other thing we can look at is to see if the time references add up. In other words, is it possible for the person to have done what he said he did in the amount of time he said he did it in? If he said, I left my house at 10 o'clock and arrived at this location at 10:30, well, we would look to see, you know, does it take, can you get there in a half an hour? If it takes 45 minutes, well, that's an indication that he didn't do that. He's just making it up, and he wasn't sure how long it would take. Then again, if it only takes 15 minutes to get to that location, then we have to wonder, well, why did it take him 30? Did he do something else? You know, was there traffic? But it's something, you know, something we would look into. So if people give us time references, we can sometimes use that to determine if they're withholding information and if they're, you know, possibly being deceptive.
Are there any particular words or phrases that could indicate deception?
Well, there are what I call unique words, several unique words. One of those is the word never. And the word never does not mean no. Therefore, you cannot substitute the word never for the word no. But deceptive people will sometimes do this. In other words, if the question is, did you sell him cocaine? A deceptive response would be, I never sold him cocaine. Well, the question, did you sell him cocaine, requires a yes or no answer. And instead of saying no, the person used the word never. But the word never does not mean no. And because it's a negative word, it often fools the interviewer into believing that the person has answered the question. And so that's a strong indication that the person is being deceptive. In that case, you know, possibly did sell them cocaine. We saw this with Roger Clemens when he testified before Congress in regards to steroid use in Major League Baseball. One of the congressmen asked him, did you during your playing career use steroids? And he responded, I never used steroids. Well, he didn't answer that specific question with a no. He used the word never. So that would be an indication that he was being deceptive. And of course, Congress felt he was being deceptive. The U.S. attorney felt he was being deceptive, but the jury decided to acquit him earlier this year. And so that's one of the unique words you want to listen for is the word no and how the person uses it. I mean, in the statement, I have never been skydiving, that's the correct way to use the word never, and it's a truthful statement. But if a person is asked a yes or no question, you cannot use the word never as a substitute for the word no. We also have another unique word is the word actually. When a person uses the word actually, they are always comparing two thoughts. And most of the time, you will see what they're comparing. For example, if the question was, did you buy a new car? And the person answered, actually, I bought a new truck. The reason he used the word actually, he was comparing car with truck. The interviewer suggested he bought a new car, and he said, no, I bought a new truck. That's no big deal. Most of the time, we can see what they're comparing. If we don't know what they're comparing, then we have some undisclosed information. And the question, what did you do last night? If the person responded, actually, I went to a party. Well, they're comparing going to a party with what? We don't know. And it may be they're comparing it to with what they did do, perhaps committing the crime. Or they may be comparing it to something else they wanted to do but decided to go to the party. But because in their mind they're thinking about something else, it causes them to unknowingly use the word actually. Again, the best answer would be, I went to a party. But by saying, I actually went to a party, it means they're making some type of comparison. And if we don't know what they're comparing, then we want to ask a few more questions and find out, you know, what was going on. So there's several, like I said, unique words to listen for. And then it's just a lot of statement analysis techniques are just based on word definitions and listening to exactly what that person's saying. So for example, if I said to you yesterday I started to cut the grass, I believe everybody recognizes that I did not finish cutting the grass because I used the word started. We all recognize that the word started means I began an action but didn't complete it. And that's a very simplistic example, but the same thing applies if a suspect in his alibi says, I left the bar at 1 a.m. and started home. It's very easy to gloss over that and picture him going home, but he didn't say that. He didn't say, I went home. He used the word started, which means he absolutely did something else before he arrived home. In fact, in his answer, he doesn't even tell us that he did go home. And so it's just things to listen for like that. In Casey Anthony, in her written statement to the police, she said that, quote, after dropping Kaylee off at Zaniah's apartment, I proceeded to head to my place of employment, Universal Studios. And so the detectives took her to Universal Studios, and as they're walking down the hall, she has to turn to them and admit to them that she doesn't work here. That was a lie. Well, we can see the lie in her language, because what she said was is that she proceeded to head to her place of employment. She didn't say, I went to my place of employment. And the word proceeded is very similar to the word started. It means you may have began an action, but it doesn't necessarily mean you completed the action. And so, again, it was hard for her to say, I went to my place of employment, because that's an outright lie. It's easier for her to say, I proceeded to go to my place of employment, because in her mind, maybe she headed in that general direction, but then didn't go there because she didn't work there. So a lot of it gets down to listening to what the person is saying and the exact words that they are using. You know, I once sat in on a trial where a police officer was accused of planting two pipe bombs and then pretending to find them for the publicity. And unlike most defendants, he took the stand and testified in his own behalf. And under cross-examination, he unknowingly confessed to planting these two pipe bombs, because what he said was, is I recovered the first device. When he talked about getting out of his cruiser and finding them in the ditch, but he used the word recovered, not discovered or found. And the word recovered means to regain or reclaim something. And yeah, it's cop talk, but even in law enforcement, we always use it to mean to regain or reclaim something, because that's the definition of the word. And he was convicted of playing the pipe bombs. But people's words will betray them. So a lot of it gets down to listening to the language, to the specific words that they are using.
Does the use of unnecessary words flag a deception?
Yes, one of the principles in statement analysis is that the shortest sentence is the best sentence. And as I just mentioned, if a person said, I went to the party, or I went to a party, that's a good statement. But by saying, actually, I went to a party, they're giving us additional information. And so that principle alone, if you just remember that the shortest sentence is the best sentence, it will help you to see additional things within the statement. People like to use qualifying words to qualify their statement. We may remember years ago when figure skater Nancy Kerrigan was struck with a metal police baton, and it turned out that the culprits were associated with rival skater Tonya Harding. And so people questioned if Tonya Harding was part of that or she knew about this attack. And in a statement she gave to the press, she said, quote, I don't know for sure anything about what's going on at all. Well, again, the shortest sentence is the best sentence. She didn't say, I don't know anything. She said, I don't know for sure anything. And so those words for sure tell us that she absolutely knows something. She doesn't know all the details. And then she added the words at all to the end of her statement. I don't know anything for sure about what's going on at all. And again, those words at all are not needed. She's overemphasizing not knowing what's going on. Well, 12 days after she gave that statement, she came out with additional information. So she was telling the whole world she knew something. She just didn't have all the details. So a good interviewer, a good reporter would have asked her right then and there, Miss Harding, tell me about the things you're not sure of, and may have gotten that information at that moment in time and not 12 days later. So extra words always give us extra information. When you can take certain words out of a statement and the statement is still grammatically correct, then that's what we're talking about. Those extra words give us extra information. And sometimes it may just be additional information, and other times it may show us that the person is being deceptive.
When a person responds to a question with a partial answer, another question, stalling, a snide remark, or generalized statements, what does that indicate?
Well, if a person stalls, perhaps stuttering or just using some pauses or using the word or ah, it's an indication that they're thinking about what to say. And so, you know, we have to ask ourselves, well, what are they thinking about? Are they trying to recall this story from memory? Obviously, if we ask somebody that something about something that happened 20 years ago, they're not going to remember all the details. But most of the time, we're investigating something that just recently occurred. And so the use of stall tactics or pauses is an indication that perhaps the story is not coming from memory. They're not viewing that parade in front of them, but they're thinking about, you know, what they should say. You had asked about if a person answers a question with a question. What that means is that the person is stalling for time to think about what their answer is going to be. When a person answers your question with any type of question, it means you ask a sensitive question. You know, one exception would be if the person says, could you repeat the question? And then you have to decide, well, did they not hear you? Or are they just using it as a stall tactic? And I'll tell you, 9 times out of 10, they're just using it as a stall tactic. And you have to ask yourself, well, why is this such a sensitive question? Why do you have to think about the answer? And again, they could answer the question truthfully once they do give an answer, but it absolutely means that they were thinking about something else, thinking about, should I lie, should I not lie? You know, how much should I tell them? What shouldn't I tell them? And so we want to ask some more questions about, you know, those areas anytime a person answers the question with a question.
What about a partial answer?
Well, the partial answer, the person obviously hasn't answered the question then. Now, a lot of times what happens is that we will ask a question and the person will give an answer, but they haven't answered our specific question. For example, a mother may ask her child, you know, did you take a cookie? And he may respond, I don't like those kind of cookies. Well, his answer may be true, I don't like those kind of cookies, but the question was, did you take a cookie? It requires a yes or no answer, and he didn't answer the specific question. And this happens a lot. You'll see it a lot on television. You'll see a lot with journalists. They will ask a question, the person will give an answer, but they haven't answered the specific question. But most of the time, the journalist will not challenge them on that. But as an interviewer, you know, we want to know all the information. So if the person hasn't answered our specific question, it means they're absolutely withholding information. You know, they haven't told us, you know, what we're asking for. And they may give a very long answer, and there's nothing wrong with that. Sometimes people don't want to just say yes or no. They want to expound on it. Nothing wrong with that. But somewhere in that lengthy answer, they have to say yes or no, either at the beginning or perhaps at the end of that answer. And so it's important, you know, when you're asking questions, to listen to see if that person answered your specific question.
What about when a person responds to a question with a snide remark?
Well, this can go either way. It depends. It would depend on how many snide remarks they're going to do. But a lot of times, it's an indication that they're, you know, perhaps stalling for time, again, to think about, how am I going to answer this question? It's a, you know, they're trying to not necessarily control the interview, but let the interviewer know that, you know, this is, you know, an inappropriate question perhaps, or a rhetorical question or something like that, that, you know, you should already know the answer to. And so, again, this would be a case of exactly what the snide remark was, how often the person's doing it, but it could be an indication, again, that the person doesn't want to answer the question or needs time to think about it, so that instead of giving an answer, they give a snide remark.
What about if the person responds to a question with a generalized statement?
Well, again, most likely if it's a generalized statement, then they haven't answered the specific question that was asked to them. And you'll see this a lot with politicians because they'll be asked.
Yes, indeed.
A very lengthy answer, but, you know, Mr. President, you haven't answered my specific question. And unfortunately, you don't hear that. You won't hear that from journalists. They'll just move on to the next question, which is crazy because you asked a question and the person technically hasn't answered it. Yeah, they gave you an answer, but they didn't answer, you know, your specific question.
What is an internal dictionary?
Well, an internal dictionary, and I like to call it a personal dictionary. Everybody has their own personal dictionary. In other words, certain words mean certain things to people. You know, if I were to say the word girl, you know, what do you visualize? I mean, some people visualize somebody that's, you know, 3 feet tall, and other people may visualize somebody that's, you know, 5 feet tall, or brown hair, blonde hair, brown eyes, green eyes. I mean, everybody has their own different definition for the word girl. No two people share the exact same definition. It may be very similar, but not exactly. And then if I say the word female, what do you visualize? Well, it's not the same thing as the word girl, because the word girl and female do not mean the exact same thing. And the same thing applies to the words woman, lady, girl, female. They all refer to the fair sex, but they don't mean the exact same thing. And everybody has their own different definition for those words. Now, in a statement, especially in a written statement where we can take our time and look at it and highlight certain words and do a comparison, we can look at a person's personal dictionary. A truthful person will be consistent in their personal dictionary. In other words, if a person views a firearm as being a gun, they will always call it a gun. They will never call it a pistol because to them, that's a gun. And so throughout their statement, whether it's verbal or written, they'll use the word gun. And using the same language is the indication that's a truthful statement, because there are no synonyms in statement analysis. As I mentioned, every word means something slightly different. Gun and pistol do not mean the same thing. But when a person is making up a story, they may follow their personal dictionary if they really try to place themselves into the story. But a lot of times what happens is, because the incident didn't happen, they're making it up, they use synonyms. They don't follow their own personal dictionary because they're not speaking from the heart. So they use synonyms. One time they call it a gun. One time they call it a pistol. And what we have to ask ourselves is, why did it go from gun to pistol? Because they do not mean the exact same thing. Now, I've seen statements from police officers where maybe they say, I drew my gun, you know, I pointed my gun, I fired my weapon. So they change the language from gun to weapon. And when the shooting stopped, they go back to calling it a gun again. So we had a change in language, and a change in language is an indication of deception, because a change in language absolutely means a change in reality. Something happened that caused the language to change. But in that example, it's probably a truthful statement because there's a justification for change in the language. That officer's personal dictionary is, the word gun means it's in my holster, it's in my hand, but the word weapon means I'm discharging it. So once the shooting begins, he calls it a weapon. Once the shooting stops, he goes back to calling it a gun. So even though we had a change in language, we had a justification for change in the language, and that would be an indication that's a truthful statement. But if a person calls it a gun, then calls it a pistol, calls it a gun, goes back to calling it a pistol, has several changes in language, it's just hard to imagine what the justification would be. And so that would be an indication that the person is making up the story because they're not following their own personal dictionary. I've seen statements where a person calls it a car throughout their statement, and then once the car, they have a flat tire, have to pull off the side of the road, once the car becomes disabled, they call it a vehicle. And that makes sense, and you'll see that in accident reports, because the word vehicle is a little bit less personal. So once the car is disabled, they call it a vehicle, but once it's operable, they call it a car. And so that's their own personal dictionary, and everybody has their own personal dictionary. Again, some people may use the word pistol throughout the statement, because to them, that's a pistol. To me, that's a gun. To somebody else, it may be a handgun. But we all have our own personal dictionary. And in some statements, not every statement, sometimes people will refer to, they'll use a noun one time, such as gun. And so you can't compare the language. But in some statements, you know, we can compare the language. You know, oftentimes you can tell which teller at a bank is skimming money by looking at the personal dictionary, because in the banking industry we talk about currency, we talk about cash, and of course we talk about money. But in their statement they may talk about currency or cash, you know, gathering up, putting it in the vault, putting it in the bag, whatever. But then once they call it money, well, we have to ask ourselves, why did the language change? Because once they put it in their purse or in their pocket, you know, most people don't put currency in their pocket. They put money in their pocket. And so because they did something that they're not telling us about, reality changed, and they're stealing the money, it causes them to unknowingly use the word money as opposed to using the word cash or currency. Their personal dictionary comes out. They don't realize they changed the language, because it makes sense to them, but to us it doesn't make sense when we really take a look at it and see that the language changed. So that's what we talk about, personal dictionary. Everybody has their own personal dictionary. Certain words mean certain things to people.
If a person avoids the mention of a person or detail in their dialogue, does that have any significance in statement analysis?
Well, if they withhold details, it would, because obviously as an interviewer, we want to know everything that this person knows. Now, even a truthful person is not going to tell us absolutely everything. Everybody edits their statement, but we want to know, you know, as much as that person is going to give us. So if they withhold certain details, that could be a significant factor. Although it may be a truthful statement, they just felt that's not something we need to know about or has no bearing on the investigation. Not mentioning the name would be very important as well, because again, we want to know everybody that was involved. And so if they withhold a certain name, there's a reason for that. Now, perhaps they don't want to incriminate that person or get him in trouble. On the other hand, it may just be they're not being deceptive, but they don't feel that this person, you know, should be bothered with whatever it is we're investigating. But, you know, again, as an interviewer, we want to know everything. I mean, when people use those plural pronouns, you know, we and us, we want to find out exactly who the we is and who the us is, or even such as the pronoun they. We want to know everybody that was involved, and so we expect a person, if they're being honest with us, to tell us everybody that was involved in the situation.
How does the breakdown of a narrative affect possible deception?
What we found is that most stories will have three segments to them. They'll have a before, a during, and after incident segment. In other words, a person will start out telling us what occurred before the incident took place. You know, perhaps they got up that morning, some things they did. Then they'll talk about the incident itself, what happened, what went down. And then they'll talk about what happened after the incident was over. Perhaps the police were called, maybe they went to the hospital, etc. By looking at how much time a person devotes to these three segments, we can get an idea if it's a truthful or deceptive statement. Because in a truthful statement, a person will usually spend about 25% of their story talking about what happened before the incident. They'll spend about 50%, the majority of their statement will be about the incident itself. And then they'll tell us, about 25% of the story about what happened after the incident was over. But what we've found is that a lot of deceptive statements will usually follow, instead of a 25-50-25 formula, they'll have something like 35-15 or 35-50-15. In other words, they'll start out with a significant beginning, setting the stage for their deceptive story, and they'll spend most of the time, about 50%, talking about the incident itself that they're making up. But to a deceptive person, they forget that there should be a significant ending. And so a lot of deceptive statements have a very short ending because that's not important to them. You know, setting the stage for it, telling about the incident itself is important, but they forget that other things go on after the incident has ended. As I said, sometimes the police are called or somebody takes a shower or somebody's comforted. And all those end up in a truthful statement. They'll come out in that statement. But a deceptive person, because none of that happened, the police weren't called, there was no gunshots, there was no pain or whatever, they forget to add that. So a lot of deceptive stories will have a very short ending. But any significant deviation from that 25-50-25 percentile breakdown is an indication of deception. I've seen some statements that had 50%. The majority of the statement was devoted towards the beginning of the statement. And then they had a very, maybe 25% incident and 25% ending. But because it had such a big beginning, it was an indication of deception. Now, again, we're looking for several things that let us know if this person is being truthful or deceptive. So just because somebody deviated from this formula of 50 or 25, 50, 25, we wouldn't say, well, you're lying to me. But if they are lying to us, it's all going to show up in other ways, as some of the ways we've already discussed.
What are common errors in phrasing questions?
Probably the biggest error is to ask a compound question. And again, you'll see this all the time with journalists. And by asking a compound question, you give the interviewer an opportunity to not answer one of the questions. In other words, the question may be, have you used cocaine or smoked marijuana? And the person may go on talking about how while they were in college, they, you know, somebody's passing a joint around and they tried it and didn't like it and didn't use good judgment and they never did it again. And they're being very forthright about their marijuana usage. But the problem is they never address the cocaine issue. And a lot of times they get away with it because they gave an answer. They did answer one of the questions, and usually they'll answer the last question asked of them. And because it sounds like they're being very truthful, the interviewer then moves on to the next question. And not realizing, well, this person didn't answer the very first question I asked. So you should never ask compound questions. They should always be just one at a time. Now, if you want, you don't have to list every specific drug. In the case of drug usage, we could just simply say, have you used the illegal drugs? And then let's see how they answer that. But we don't want to ask compound questions. Now, sometimes when we try to solicit a confession, we may ask a compound question because we want to make it easy for the interviewer to confess. So we may say, did you take the money because you were greedy or because you wanted to feed your family? And we know they took the money because they're greedy, but we're giving them a way out by saying, okay, I took it because I want to feed my family. And so when we're just looking for a confession, yeah, we may ask compound questions. But when we want to solicit information, we want to ask our questions one at a time, see how the person answered it, and then, you know, ask the second question.
If our listeners would like more information, do you have a website that they could browse to?
I do. It's www.statementanalysis.com. And any interviews I see on television of, you know, high profile cases, or if I can get a copy of these interviews, I will analyze them and I post them on my website, and it's there for people to read. So by reading my analysis of these various interviews, you can learn a lot of the techniques, you know, what to look for in a statement. Did the person answer the specific question? Did they answer the question with a question? And then the books that you mentioned that I have are available on my website or Amazon.com.
Yeah, those are the books, I Know You Are Lying and Don't Be Deceived.
Correct. And I also have some online training if you're interested in learning more about the statement analysis techniques. It's an online course. It's equivalent to what I share in my one-day seminars. It's conducted at your own pace. You don't have to log in at a certain time. You just go onto the website and go through the first lesson. There are two statements you have to analyze and send me your analysis. I provide you with feedback, and then you're allowed to move on to the second lesson. And it takes most people probably 16 hours, but I give people, you know, 90 days to complete the training, as much time as you need to complete it. There's no rush.
Okay, fair enough. And you're going to be doing a seminar this February at Hillsborough Community College in Tampa, Florida.
That's correct. The college is hosting a one-day seminar on the statement analysis techniques.
Okay, and that's going to be at Hillsborough Community College at their Ebor campus, because that's where the criminal justice program is.
Yes, and there'll be some information on my website, as well as other seminars I am conducting about that seminar. It's February 25th.
February 25th, okay. And that's 2013. And you'll give an announcement with the costs and that sort of thing, and the hours, you know, where it's located and so forth.
Correct. Yes, you can find out all on my website under seminars.
We've been interviewing today retired Deputy United States Marshal Mark McLish. He is the author of the books I Know You Are Lying, Don't Be Deceived, and the Kindle ebook, 10 Easy Ways to Spot a Liar. He also is the developer of the Statement Analyzer software. Mark, thanks for being a guest today on The Edge.
Thank you, Tom. I enjoyed it.
I'm Tom Smith, the producer and host of The Edge. We'll be back again next week with another interesting guest. Thanks for listening. Thank you.